If you can't feel and picture that image of the scars of poverty on the face of an innocent child, go to your neurologist because there's something wrong with the way your brain's hooked up. If you want to win hearts and minds, you better start with people's hearts, because otherwise they're not really going to care all that much about what's on your mind.
Good morning and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. It's a pleasure today to continue our series of talks that are looking at and trying to figure out what's going to go on in the next presidential election. As many of you know, Chuck Todd, the very savvy political director of NBC News, was here several weeks ago, and several weeks in the future, Brian Kaplan, who is a professor of economics at George Mason University and has written a very interesting book called The Myth of the Rational Voter, which argues that people do not make economically rational decisions when they're deciding how to vote, will be here to give, I believe, a somewhat different perspective than today's speaker will give. Today's speaker is Drew Weston, who has published to great acclaim and interest The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. Professor Weston is a professor of psychology and psychiatry at Emory University, where he's been since 2002. Before that, he was at the University of Michigan, where he received his PhD in clinical psychology, and where he was twice honored as the best teaching professor in the entire university. He has taught at Harvard Medical School and was chief psychologist at Cambridge Hospital. His undergraduate degree is from Harvard, and his master's is from the University of Sussex in England. Please welcome the author of The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation, Drew Weston.
Well, thank you very much, George, for the invitation to be here at the Miller Center, and to the Miller Center in general for inviting me out here to UVA, and thank you all for coming. I do have a rather unusual pedigree to be talking about politics. As someone who has been a scientist and a clinician for about 25 years in the fields of psychology and psychiatry rather than in political science. But I thought, given that, I would do what's in my DNA to do, which is to start with an experiment, and you're all going to be the subjects. So what I'd like to do is I want you to remember the following pairs of words. Are you ready? Ocean, moon, glasses, chair, face, cell phone. Okay, do you have those? Now count backwards in your head from 100 to 95. And just nod when you get there. Okay, we have some quick numbers. Okay, good. Math is intact. Now, what I'd like to do when I raise my hand is I want you to, and you really have to just say it out loud, shout out loud, the name of the first automobile that comes to your mind. Okay, you ready? Okay, no consensus. You two could be in Congress. Now I'm going to do it again, but this time when I raise my hand, I want you to name the first laundry detergent that comes to your mind. Ready? Tide. Well, isn't that interesting? Virtually all of you said Tide. I could do this in a room from anywhere from a table of four people I'm having dinner with to a room of 3,000 people, where roughly somewhere between 85 and 95% of the people will say Tide when I ask that question. I should let you know that Procter & Gamble would love this. The market share of Tide is 41%. Now, that's a huge market share, but it is less than half of the market share that we got in this room. Now, if I were to ask you, and I won't do it today just because we don't have a lot of time, but if I were to ask you why you said Tide, actually, I can't resist. Did you say Tide?
Yes.
Why did you say Tide?
I think it was because I knew with the 95, the I sound, and then when you said ocean moon,
ooh, the winner of today's lottery. For those of you who couldn't hear that, He said something about the eyesight, then said it may have been something about Ocean Moon. And in fact, what it was, normally what happens is people say, I don't know, I kind of picture that orange box, or I see, I think that's what my mother used, or we used that at home. And those are the kind of answers that you get in focus groups when you ask people questions like, should John Kerry respond to the Swiftboat ads? Because what people give you is their best conscious guesses about what's actually happening, largely outside of their awareness. Because most of political persuasion, like most thought processes, emotional processes, motivational processes, actually occur outside of awareness. So when you ask somebody, you know, why do you think you like that ad, or do you think it would, do you think that particular ad influenced you, or do you think that it would influence you if John Kerry either did or didn't respond to Swiftboat ads? You're asking a question that's about as sensible as asking, what do you think's happening in your pancreas right now? Because the reality is, if you ask conscious questions about unconscious processes, people just make up the answers. What in fact happened was that I primed you with the words Ocean Moon. And the reason that what I did after that, when I asked you to count backwards, when I asked you to name automobiles, was just to clear your cognitive palate. It was to distract you so it wouldn't be conscious. But what happened in this experiment is I activated what's called a network of associations. That is, a network of thoughts and feelings and ideas and images and memories that are all connected up in our mind through experience. So when I activated the tide net, the ocean moon network, what you can see is that ocean, moon, waves, and tide are all connected associatively. Now, you never became conscious of waves or tide, but those are now at a heightened state of activation in your brains or in your minds because of having said ocean, moon. When I then said laundry detergents, it activated a network that includes all, fab, cheer, and once again, tide. The only point of intersection of those two networks is tied, and that's why that rose to consciousness, because it had been doubly activated. Now, why do I start with this example? I start with the example because I wanted to ask the next question, which is, suppose somebody knew how to shape and activate networks of association just like this in politics. Well, the answer is that actually somebody does, and they're called the GOP. I'm going to give you an example. Well, I should, by the way, forewarned is forearmed. I should tell you that my first commitment is to science. My second is I am a Democrat. So I will. The good news for the Republicans in the room is that, and for people Republicans listening to this is that. You all, your leaders and your campaign strategists already know about 70% of this. The bad news for Democrats in that score is that yours know about 10%. The other news is that, you know, part of my goal in writing this book was to even the playing field so that both sides would have an equal knowledge about how the mind actually works, because behind every campaign lies a vision of how the mind actually works. And if you start with the wrong vision of mind and brain, you'll actually run some very, very bad campaigns, and I'll show you some examples of that. But let's take an example. Liberal. Now, this was the term that was used. It was used by Thomas Jefferson liberally to describe who he was, and it was used by all the founders to describe who they were. But this is a term that that used to define the left. It used to define what a Democrat was. Why don't Democrats use this anymore? Well, 20 years ago was the last time a Democratic presidential nominee actually tried to use this word to describe himself. It was Michael Dukakis, and I think, as you'll recall, he lost. The last time before that was over 20 years before, and that was Lyndon Johnson. So it's been over 40 years since a Democrat has used this word to describe himself when running for president of the United States. I actually need to say to describe himself or herself, because a couple of debates ago, we heard Hillary Clinton get asked the question, you were a liberal. And she did a nice job of saying what the tradition of liberalism was and then said, no, I'm a progressive, because progressive has not been contaminated by the associations that liberal has been. Well, it is a remarkable thing that the conservative movement has been able to establish a network of associations to liberal that has literally made it impossible for liberals to use it to describe themselves. I mean, can you imagine a day in America where someone couldn't proudly say, I'm a conservative? Once upon a time, it was like that, actually. In the era of Barry Goldwater, a Goldwater conservative was not a very good thing in a lot of people's minds. It has completely shifted. And the reason it's completely shifted is because what the conservative movement did was to pour billions of dollars and 40 years' worth of time in developing a messaging infrastructure. That is, a way of talking to people about what a liberal is, what a conservative, what their policy positions are, what their values are, in ways that are emotionally compelling, that they've market tested, that they've taught their candidates how to use. And Democrats and what do you call it, that they can't be liberals anymore, don't have any kind of infrastructure like that. And we've seen a huge imbalance between the two. Just to give you actually an example of this, I was watching on, I think it was MSNBC last year during the election, a debate between a Democrat and a Republican congressman and congresswoman on the question of, are Democrats going to raise your taxes? First of all, no self-respecting Republican would be on that show, because they'd say you got to change the premise, because the premise is already setting the Democrat at a disadvantage. But the Democrat goes on the show, and he said something or other about, he seemed like a really nice guy, something about something subsidies were going up and some were going down, and I think his hands were moving like this. I remember that much. But I, as a politically informed voter, had no idea what he was talking about. Republican congresswoman comes on. She says, you know, the difference between us is that they see this as revenue stream. We see this as your paycheck. Now, why is that more powerful? That is much more powerful, because what she's saying is that we Republicans understand that you work hard for that money. We're not going to take it away unless there's a really good reason. When he's saying this will go up and this will go down, I'm listening to this and I'm thinking, well, I don't know what effect this is going to have on how much money I bring home from my family. But she just told me how she thinks about it in a way that is emotionally compelling. That's the difference between starting with a vision of the mind that suggests that we are dispassionate, cool, calculating machines, where if you just give people the right facts and figures and the right policies and the you poll to find out which policies are and which positions and which issues are going to win for you, you present those things and people will come. Versus the idea that actually we are much more emotional beings than that, and that if you want to appeal to people, you better start with their emotions and their values. So let's take a look at this network around liberals. What's associated with liberal? Liberal elite, big government, tax and spend, cut and run, special interests. Those are the first thing that comes to even liberals' minds when they hear liberal, because of the successful branding by the Republicans and the conservative movement more generally of what a liberal is. Let's go ahead and flesh out the network of associations. We've now got Volvo driving, sushi eating, latte drinking, godless atheists. Here's a liberal. Okay? I see a few of you in the audience. So, all right, so that is what a liberal is in most people's minds. Well, again, how did that happen? It happened because of very, very effective branding and an understanding that Republicans tend to have, who often come much more from business, that you would never put all of your money into research and development, maybe some into manufacturing, and zero into a marketing budget. Democrats, when they think about how to run campaigns or when they give money to think tanks, they tend to give money to policy think tanks. They don't give money to messaging think tanks that get at how do you sell your ideas, because ideas don't just sell themselves. It's a great fantasy on the side of the left that's how it works, but it actually, and I'll show you the data in a second, it actually doesn't. So let's take a look for a second at how conservatives and what do you call it speak. We can all recite the conservative catechism, right? Whether you're a Republican or Democrat listening to this, you all know that when I say, what does a conservative believe in? A conservative believes in strong national defense. A strong conservative believes in, this one's a little humorous these days, fiscal responsibility. A conservative believes in the Second Amendment. A conservative believes that that life begins at conception. A conservative believes in small government and low taxes. I mean, those are things that just jump right off of our lips. If I were to ask you, what does a liberal or a Democrat or a progressive believe in? Can anybody even say? You know, I'm advising some Democrats right now, and I can't say what it is that a Democrat or a, what do you call it, actually believes in. Because when something happens, like you would think, well, what do Democrats believe on guns? Well, I don't really know. I mean, this is Virginia, and we had the Virginia Tech, the massacre here just last year, and there was no response from the Democrats in Congress. So what does that tell you that the Democrats believe about guns? I guess nothing. Republicans were quite clear what they believed about guns, and a lot of them said it. They said, well, if everyone had been armed, that guy wouldn't have made it very far. You know, I mean, that's a position. It's a principled stand. It's that everyone has the right to have a gun, because no ifs, ands, or buts, because that's what the Second Amendment says, and it's our only way to protect our freedom. We know that principle from the right. There is no corresponding principle from milk. What's the principle on the left from abortion? Well, if you're in New York or New Jersey or Connecticut, or you're in Northern California, or maybe some of the big cities, you can say that you're pro-choice. But otherwise, what you usually hear is something like this: well, I kind of sort of believe in a woman's right to choose, but I voted for the parental notification and the partial birth abortion ban. And the principle is, you're listening for it and you have no idea what it is that a Democrat, or what you would call it, stands for. So if we talk about speaking liberally, what are the kind of terms that are used on the left? Well, the kind of terms are, I want you to listen to this one for emotional appeal: the environment. Did that just get you right here? Makes you feel nothing. The environment is the most bland term you could ever develop for anything that you wanted people to get excited about. The environment can literally mean how warm it is in your car. I mean, it can mean the business environment. It can be the climate. It means anything. It is as bland a term that has as few possible emotional associations as you could possibly get, unless you are an environmentalist, or unless you have heard the conservative message on it, which is that you immediately think of tree huggers and spotted owls. I mean, that's what, you know, those are the first things that come to mind. Imagine if Al Gore in 2000, when he was running for president, he actually didn't talk about the environment. The reason he didn't talk about the environment was because his advisors convinced him that it wouldn't win him any votes and it would hurt him in Michigan, where they've got the big three automakers. Now, I'll tell you, I spent some years in Michigan. It would not have been hard to put together a terrific campaign ad in Michigan with a father and his son walking by Lake Michigan, with a father saying, "You know, I remember when we used to be able to, my grandfather and my father and I used to be able to catch the fish from Lake Michigan and bring it home that day and eat it. We can't do that anymore. I want that back. Vote Democratic." How hard would that be to craft that kind of environmental message? Or to say to go to one of the big three automakers and say, "You know what? We're losing to the Japanese. And you know what we're going to do about that? We're going to win on something. We're going to win on, we are going to commit ourselves to developing automobiles that save the earth and make sure that we bequeath to our children the kind of earth that our parents and grandparents took the time and effort to bequeath to us." Imagine if they had done that. Completely different message. I heard the House Minority Leader in Georgia the other day gave a speech. He's been reading my book. And he said, you know, he comes from rural Georgia. And he said, you know, I'm tired of talking about the environment. I want to talk about the fish. I want to be able, with my son, to be able to eat the fish that we catch in the streams of this state. Want to get across an argument about the environment to rural Georgians, rural Virginians? People who fish, that's the way that you get it across. That makes the environment real. Or imagine if Al Gore had talked, if he had been handled by Hollywood producers instead of by Democratic consultants in 2000, who had realized that you don't separate a candidate from his values. You will always lose if you do that. You don't tell someone, don't run on what you're passionate about. Your job as a consultant is to help them figure out how to talk about it in a way that conveys that passion to others so that it'll be infectious. Imagine if Al Gore had shown those pictures of the glaciers falling that you saw in An Inconvenient Truth. Imagine if he'd shown those pictures of the polar ice caps melting. Imagine if he had if he'd used words like he used in An Inconvenient Truth, when instead of talking about the environment, he said, "This is our only home." Did you feel that when I said that? It's a completely different feeling, and it gets you to a very different place as a voter. Suddenly, you realize why this matters. And my guess is that if you'd just shown Florida voters that picture of what Florida is going to look like in 50 years if we don't do anything about carbon emissions, and said, "This is the land that you will not be giving your children and grandchildren in 50 years if you vote for my opponent," my guess is that we probably wouldn't have been counting dimple chads in Florida. The point is that Democrats, when they use language, they use emotionally bland language. It isn't just the environment. You can talk about universal health care. But what associations does that evoke? What networks does that evoke? It evokes socialized medicine, evokes single-party payer, it invokes lack of choice, it invokes, well, am I going to lose my doctor because I like my doctor? It invokes for middle-class people who like their health care, am I going to lose the health care that I had? All of that gets activated by universal health care, along with the associations to everybody getting covered. Why don't you instead talk about how, instead say, what I believe in is a family doctor for every family. How can you be against a family doctor for every family? I mean, there's no way to be against that in a principled way unless you sound like you really are lacking in compassion, that you don't care about people who, unlike yourself, say, in the Congress, don't have such a great plan for yourself and for your kids. Or when the Democrats were trying to get Karl Rove to testify under oath, you can say, you know, Karl Rove needs to testify under oath because if he doesn't, if there's no transcript, it'll be he said, she said. You can say all that. All that's perfectly true. Or you can say, Mr. Bush, just what is it about so help me God that you find so offensive? It says exactly the same thing, but it does it in a different way. And what we have in America today is the idea that there's a group of values voters, and then there's the rest of America. Well, yeah, the reality is that all Americans are values voters. I mean, I'm a professor, so I'm tenured, which means I'm never going to be poor. I can do terrible things other than, you know, than kill the president of Emory University, and I'll still have my job. You know, I can dement slowly and eventually, you know, eventually someone will kind of maybe, you know, look the other way when I speak in faculty meetings, and I'll get the message. But the reality is that I'm not going to be poor. So why do I care about poverty? I care about it because of the empathic distress signals that are part of our evolutionary history. I care about it because my parents, when we drove by areas of town where people were poor, would say, God, isn't that awful? As opposed to, look at those people. Those kind of sentiments are what shape all of our voting behavior. And if you run as the party of making the trains run on time, of cleaning up, you know, toxic waste dumps against the party of morality, if you run as the party of the profane against the party of the sacred, you're not going to have much luck in national elections. And in fact, since FDR, we've only elected and reelected one Democrat to the presidency in over 60 years, and we've only failed to reelect, that was William Jefferson Clinton, we have only failed to elect one Republican to the presidency in that same period of time, and that was George H.W. Bush, who ran like a Democrat and paid for it. So why do emotions matter? Why does speaking in emotionally compelling ways matter? It matters because if you look at the best predictors of people's voting behavior over the last 50 years, this is taken from tens of thousands of national surveys of voters, you find that in order, here are the things that influence voters. First and foremost, their feelings towards the parties and their principles. That counts for about 80% of people's votes. And if you don't believe that, think about the last time you voted an election. What did you do? You looked at the top of the ticket, you knew a lot about the people at the top of the ticket. Further down the ticket you get, you look for the D or the R. And why do you look for the D or the R? You look for the D or the R because that tells you this person probably shares my values more than the other person does. That's not an irrational strategy for voting, especially when you look at the second best predictor, which is the gut level feelings towards the candidates. What does this person make me feel? Well, what the this again may seem to you like a really irrational thing, but what ends up happening in a Republican form of government like ours, little r, for Republican, is that a representative democracy is we're voting from everybody from president on down to county commissioner on down to county sheriff on down to in some municipalities to the dog catcher. So if you're voting all the way down that list, the idea that you could know what issues and policies are supported by each of the candidates at every one of those levels of government is simply impossible. So what do? You use the shorthand. You learn as much as you can about the races that you think matter the most to you, whether and that may be local races for some people, but for most people that's the national races. And then down the road, you vote the D or the R because that's closest to your values unless you've felt something about this person who's got the D or the R by their name that you would normally vote with them. You go, I just don't trust him. And then you vote for the other one. That's how most people vote. And I would suggest that that's actually a pretty rational strategy for voting. It's a way that you make sure that someone with your values who you believe you can trust is the person who you pull that lever for. The third biggest influence on people's voting is their feelings towards the candidate's personal attributes. So leadership, integrity, compassion, competence, not so much. But those are the next set of feelings that influence people's votes. And way down the list is feelings towards the candidate's policies. And if you get to the very bottom of the list, this actually if you try to use an equation including all these to predict people's voting behavior for president, you'll find that this one actually doesn't predict unless it influences things higher up on that hierarchy. And that is facts about the candidate's policies. So what do Republicans do? Republicans start at the top of that hierarchy. They go for feelings towards the parties and their principles. They carefully articulate their principles. They do it with emotion. They talk about what their values are, and they speak with conviction. And even if you don't like their convictions, you know what their convictions are. What do Democrats do? We don't know what their convictions are on so many issues. The Iraq War, I think, is the latest example, latest in best or worst example you could use, where the Democrats were elected in 2007 by not only their own constituents, but by 70% of amendments of independents who said it's time to get our soldiers out of Iraq. So what did they do? They talked a lot of tough words, and then when it came time to vote, they voted for a bill that had some accountability built in. And when George Bush vetoed it, what did they do? They backed down. What message did that send about what Democrats really believe and what Democrats are really like? The message it sent was the meta message, which is that you can't trust these people in the face of aggression. That's the only thing that Americans heard, was that they backed down in the face of aggression. That's what Americans learned by John Kerry saying nothing for 3 weeks when the Swift Boat ads occurred. The story being told about him at the time by George W. Bush was, watch out for this guy. If America's attacked, he's not going to fight back. What happens? He gets attacked. He doesn't fight back. What does that tell the American people? I believe it's a rational response to hear the real message behind that and to say, this guy, I don't trust him if we in fact are attacked. He won't even protect himself and his own integrity and his own honor. What Republicans next go to is they go to that level of feelings about the candidates. They want to make sure that they pick a candidate who they feel comfortable with. And they tend to pick candidates with high emotional intelligence. I'd watch out, by the way, for Mike Huckabee if he can stay in there long enough with his with just enough donations to keep him afloat. There's a candidate who's got a lot of emotional intelligence. Thing they do is they train their candidates. You will never see a Republican on television who hasn't been through at least 3 months of conservative training camp and how to talk about conservative things, how to talk right. You will rarely see a Democrat who has ever been prepared in anything like that way. We now have the beginnings on the left of some typically 1 day or 2 day or occasionally 8 day trainings that span over time, but nothing like what the right has, and that's a huge difference between the parties. What do the Democrats practice? They practice trickle-up politics. That is, they start at the bottom of the hierarchy of influences on people's voting behavior, and they kind of hope that it'll trickle up into their voting. And that's about as valid as trickle-down economics. So let me wrap up. I'm going to have to. This is another subliminal slide, as is this. But I wanted to conclude with something that a different time certainly in Democratic politics, when Democrats talked a different way, when instead of hiding their values in the fine print of their policies, they actually talked about what their values were. This was a week after Bloody Sunday, when many of you will remember this, is when Americans watched in horror live and in real time as the 600 civil rights marchers peacefully marching from Selma to Montgomery made it about 6 blocks before they were attacked by the state troopers and state police and the deputized lynch mob. It ignited the country for the cause of civil rights. And next week, Lyndon Johnson got up on television, and this is how he began in an address to the joint houses of Congress.
At times, history and fate meet at a single time, in a single place, to shape a turning point in man's unending search for freedom. So it was at Lexington and Concord. So it was a century ago at Appomattox. So it was last week in Selma, Alabama.
Now, what did he just do? We don't think of Lyndon Johnson as being a brilliant orator. But what he just did was to create a set of associations between what happened in Selma and the blood that had been shed by Americans in Concord, in Lexington, and in the Civil War for our freedom. He just created a network where there wasn't one before. And finally, what I'm going to conclude with is the way that he drove home the point was not with an appeal to, let me tell you about my civil rights plan. You know, I don't remember Martin Luther King's I Have a Plan speech. But I do remember I have a dream, and I remember exactly what his dream was, and it's been a lot of years since he told us about it. Well, I was giving a talk about this in New York several months ago, and someone who was there at the time told me that when the speech was written, that this was the paragraph that was actually, the speech was written by Dick Goodwin, Doris Kearns Goodwin's husband, but that Lyndon Johnson had inserted this paragraph, and you'll see why.
My first job after college was as a teacher in Cotulla, Texas, in a small Mexican-American school. Few of them could speak English, and I couldn't speak much Spanish. My students were poor, and they often came to class without breakfast, hungry. And they knew, even in their youth, the pain of prejudice. They never seemed to know why people disliked them. But they knew it was so, because I saw it in their eyes. And somehow, you never forget what poverty and hatred can do when you see its scars on the hopeful face of a young child. I never thought then, in 1928, that I would be standing here in 1965. It never even occurred to me in my fondest dreams that I might have the chance to help the sons and daughters of those students and to help people like them all over this country. But now I do have that chance. And I'll let you in on a secret. I mean to use it.
I should just note that at the end of that applause, he brought his teeth back in, his fangs back in, and he said, and I hope you'll use it with me. Now, why was that such a brilliant paragraph? If you can't feel and picture that image of the scars of hatred and poverty on the face of an innocent child, go to your neurologist because there's something wrong with the way your brain's hooked up. And he understood that. He remembered that memory from years earlier, and it had stuck in his mind so much that it ended up in a speech 40 years later. And the point that I want to make about this by closing with this is that if you want to win hearts and minds, you better start with people's hearts, because otherwise they're not really going to care all that much about what's on your mind. Thank you.
Shortly before he was assassinated, Martin Luther King was asked about the issue of interracial marriages, which of course had been what drove a lot of the concern of people about any sort of mixing of the races. And he very famously said, "I want to be the white man's brother, not his brother-in-law." If you were advising candidates today on the civil union's gay marriage issue, what tact would you suggest that they take?
It's a great question. My first answer would be that we've gotten away from the idea that candidates should start with their own values. And I think it's just so essential that candidates remember that that's what matters first, and that if there's a gulf between your values and the values of your constituents, The job of you as a communicator and the job of your consultants is to help you find the right ways to talk with people about things that they might not even agree with you on, but hopefully that will move people closer to the values that you believe in. So what, you know, what Martin Luther King was illustrating in a really marvelous way with that was he understood that the issue of the mixing of the races was going to derail the civil rights civil rights movement. And he understood that what was most important was that black people be able to vote. And what he figured is, down the road, when people see that that's not a disaster, when they see that drinking from the same water fountains, from intermixing on the bus is not going to kill them, what's going to happen is they're going to see the same thing about the mixing of the races. And you know, that's the term that was used at the time. And in fact, 10 years later, the Supreme Court struck down legislation that prevented interracial marriage. So if, you know, if I were advising a Democrat who believed or a Republican who believed in gay marriage or civil unions, I would advise them to remember what Martin Luther King did and what he illustrated, a powerful psychological principle called exposure, which is as people get used to things and see it over time that they're afraid of, they become less scary to them, and that's how you get rid of people's phobias. So you know. To say to people, make the simple distinction, again, if you think about networks, the simple distinction between what you are in the eyes of the law and what you are in your church or your synagogue is an easy distinction to make. To say, look, we are all Americans, and if you're comfortable using this language, we are all God's children. And that makes us all equal in this country. And in the eyes of the law, we are certainly equal, and our Constitution tells us that. And the idea that we would not extend to someone benefits, health benefits, to their partner when they've had a 15-year monogamous relationship with that partner because of our particular religious beliefs about what constitutes sin. And by the way, there's a lot more adultery committed among straight people in this country than there is homosexuality. So, you know, it's easy to pick on the sins that you're not particularly interested in. But gluttony is another one. It's about a third of us. So, you know, anyone who's ready to cast the first stone, you go cast it. But the reality is that in the eyes of the law, we have to be equal. But, you know, we've had in this country for 200 years, no one has ever forced a Catholic priest to marry two people who'd been divorced. And no one is ever going to step into your Baptist church and to tell you that you have to marry gay people. These are two completely different things. And the last thing that if I were talking with voters about this and I wanted to move them towards my values on this, if my values were that gay people should either be able to be married or to have civil unions, is to distinguish between two things. One of those is prejudice, and the other is religious conviction. And to simply start out with there's a story I sometimes tell about when I was a young child. My older brother was a little odd. And when you get to be about 8 years old, you start to notice those things. Psychologists call it social comparison. And I realized that he was a little bit different. And he was not gay, but he was odd. But the language for talking about oddness at that point was gay, but we didn't use the word gay. So I remember a time he did something that really made me mad when I was eight, nine years old, and I said, "You faggot." Now, why do I mention that? I mention that for two reasons. One is that was not out of religious conviction. That was out of prejudice. We all naturally feel prejudice towards people who look different from us, who sound different from us, who don't speak our language, who are different in various ways, and we do that from the time we're little. The other is that my brother has died since, and I can't take that back. Now, why do I give that example? I give that example because it powerfully reminds people that, you know what, this was my brother. He could have been gay. And the reality is that if what you're feeling when you're making decisions about gay marriage or civil unions, or you're thinking and feeling about this issue, is hatred, that is not your faith speaking, because every faith that's represented in this country has at its core compassion and mercy and love and not hatred. So you need to pull apart those two things.
Thank you, Dr. Watson. That was a very interesting talk. In your research, in your book, and I read it in Michael Shermer's column in Scientific American, which is very good, you have brain scans showing that the rational parts of the brain aren't used in some political discussions. And it was mainly with people who are very strong Kerry supporters or very strong Bush supporters. And clearly, a lot of our elections are going to actually swing on the swing voters, which are more in the middle. Do they have the same response? Did you find they have more reason going on than what is just straight emotion?
Well, you know, it's a great question. This is a real irony. What the questioner is asking about is we did a study during the 2004 election where we scanned the brains of partisan Democrats and Republicans as they were presented with threatening information about their candidate at George W. Bush or John Kerry. In the form of a reasoning task, where we gave them the first slide comes up and says, you know, in 1996, John Kerry said X. And then the next slide comes up, and again, we're scanning their brains as this is all happening, and says, John Kerry in 2004 on Meet the Press said Y. Exact opposite. And then we ask them in the next slide, you know, consider that Mr. Kerry's words and actions are inconsistent. Now, if you look at this from a rational standpoint, this is a classic reasoning task, and every study that's ever been done of reasoning tasks have shown that certain parts of the brain, right up around here, are activated when people reason. I mean, there are other parts of the brain that are activated, but these are some of the primary circuits that are involved in reasoning. We then asked them to rate on a 4-point scale the extent to which they thought that that these two statements were contradictory. And we gave them 6 for Bush and 6 for Kerry and 6 for a neutral person like Tom Hanks, politically neutral like Tom Hanks or Hank Aaron. So what did we find? We found that the reasoning circuits never turned on. They were essentially the dead zone for partisans. And that we also found that partisans did exactly what we expected, which is on average they couldn't see the contradictions for their own guy, but they could easily see it for the opposition. And this is 80% of the population that we're talking about. And interestingly, you know, you say, well, don't emotional appeals work for, you know, mostly for uneducated voters? Well, the most partisan voters are often the more educated voters. And it turns out that any advantage that those of us who are educated have in terms of this stuff is completely canceled out by our partisanship, because we can just twirl the cognitive kaleidoscope until it comes up, and we have the rational abilities to do it until we come up with a rationalization that fits exactly what we wanted to believe in the first place. And the question that the questioners ask is one I wish we had the data on from brain scanning about what you know, what independents look like, what do swing voters look like. The data from large national surveys and others do similarly suggest that what sways independence is not primarily the facts and figures. It is the kind of emotional appeals that I described. But by emotional appeals, I don't mean, again, just, you know, emoting loudly or just choosing the right words. If you listen to the structure of Ronald Reagan speeches or Bill Clinton speeches, you always heard the same thing, which is they would lead with something emotionally powerful that drew you in. You know, they would lead with a story or a moral question facing the country or a dilemma that would cause you to have some kind of feeling. They would then say, what has just gone on that's caused this? What am I going to do about this? And they would conclude with something emotional to bring you back in, to let them know that they cared about this and they were going to do something about it. That's the structure of a successful emotional argument that reaches independence. So, you know, just to give you an example about this, in the last, you know, I was critical a moment ago about the Democrats in Congress response to the Iraq War. And, you know, my point of view on this, frankly, is that it, in some ways, as a politician, it doesn't matter exactly what stance you take on or what position you take on the Iraq War, as long as it isn't cowering in the corner or the fetal position. You know, and if you want to get people get our soldiers out of Iraq, what Democrats have done is they've gotten terrified by we're worried about independence. They're worried about swing voters. And so what they did was they tried to craft centrist stance and to try to essentially find some kind of compromise solution. But you know what? There isn't an easy story that tells why should we compromise in the next year between 1,000 Americans wounded or killed. I'm sorry, 10,000 Americans wounded or killed and zero. I haven't yet heard that story, that narrative that would explain that. But what has captured Democrats on this one, has stopped them from moving, is this idea that they'll say we don't support our troops. And that was openly what Democrats said is when they cast their vote in May, which was followed, by the way, with a drop of 12 points in the polls by independents, when they cast their vote giving the president another appropriation for Iraq, they actually lost votes among centrists, even though they thought that they were taking a centrist position. And the reason I would argue that that happened, that it was completely predictable, and in fact was predicted in advance, was that that they were thinking that what people were listening to was their policy when people were getting the meta message, that they were backing down and that they weren't following through. They weren't people of conviction. And so if instead they had taken on that concept of support our troops, imagine if Democrats, instead of accepting that what the Republicans did so successfully, which was to ally two networks with support our troops. One is support our men and women in uniform. Is there anybody who doesn't do that? With another one, which is to support their deployment to Iraq. Those are completely unrelated concepts or networks, but support our troops was used to bring them together. It was a brilliant move as a way to get people to feel the same feeling towards the troops that they feel towards the Iraq war. So how could Democrats have broken that for those independents in the middle? They could have done something like this. They could have said, President Bush, you really want to support our troops? Then why don't you start out by not making their families take up a collection for their body armor? You want to support our troops, you armor their Humvees so they don't lose their lives and limbs when they don't need to. You want to support our troops, don't send other people's sons and daughters to fight in a war that you wouldn't send your own children to fight in. You want to support our troops, don't send them into somebody else's civil war. You want to support our troops when they come back injured, don't warehouse them with cockroaches in Walter Reed Hospital. If you want to know what it means to support our troops, when they come back to this country, to shores they will never see again, don't whisk their bodies in the middle of the night as if you're ashamed of them. But do what every other administration has done in our 200-year history, which is you display their flag-draped coffins proudly so that people understand the sacrifice that they have made. And you really want to know what it means to support our troops, you bring them home. Now, that's an alternative rendering of support our troops that goes straight for the middle. But what it does now is it creates a different set of networks around what it means to support our troops.
Thank you, Professor Weston. I think that this idea that you're putting forth of using emotional association by the Democrats to sort of combat an incredible facility with this on the right has great prescriptive potential, but I wonder how much it has so sort of in context, specifically because there's another effect that the Republicans have effectively used for the last 40 years, which is the repeated exposure of this emotional association. A lot of Democrat language is blunted. There are people who are beginning to use some of the kind of rhetoric you're talking about, but it's very hard for that to sort of puncture, given this sort of anesthetized cloud around Democratic language that's built up. And I guess, do you have anything prescriptive sort of in context to sort of use that going forward?
Yes, and that is that a remarkable thing is that you would think the Democrats would have caught on in 1994 when Speaker Newt Gingrich hired Frank Luntz to develop the language for the contract with America, and when the Republicans won the majority for the first time in 50 years after the New Deal, that they would have thought, whoa, we got to look at what they just did. Because what they were doing was they picked a brilliant wordsmith, Frank Luntz, who sometimes he can get a little Orwellian. I wouldn't go into the realm of calling a bill crafted by America's leading polluters the Clear Skies Edition, but that's just my own values. But a lot of what Frank Luntz does is simply brilliant. He's a guy who's got a great ear for emotion and a great ear for language, but he also has, as a PhD in political science, he has an understanding of experimental method, and he believes in testing any of those ideas that he has. So it wasn't an accident that he came up with a language. You know, on how do you get tort reform pushed through? How do you get people excited about tort reform? You talk about the endless tide of litigation. Boy, does that give you a different feeling about it? And call it common sense legal reform. You know, how do you get people to worry about the 2% of people who were losing money from their estates to taxes? When instead of calling it the estate tax, you call it the death tax. Well, why is that so powerful? It's so powerful because it makes you think, wait a minute. You already got taxed once on that when you were alive for working for it. Now you're getting taxed for dying? I mean, how do you not have that reaction when you hear a death tax? Well, that's the kind of language that Frank Luntz developed and that the Republicans have used very deliberately and brilliantly over the years. What a Democrat, if you'd be shocked to know, I suspect, that there is no one on the Democratic, in the Democratic Party, for example, who's got the job description of watching Republicans' language and following changes in it. Now, knowing that Republicans so carefully use their language, you'd think that, for example, when President Bush shifted from using the war against bin Laden, the war against terrorists, the war against terrorism, the war against al-Qaeda right after 9/11, and 3 months later, suddenly those words never appeared. It was always the war on terror. You'd think that someone in DNC headquarters would have said, what's going on here? What are they trying to accomplish? Well, what they were trying to accomplish was crystal clear. It was two things. One is, and they know this research. I mean, the irony is, I have to say, as a psychologist and as a scientist, is that the party that views itself as governing with science, the Democratic Party, tends to campaign with faith and intuition, and the party that tends to govern with faith and intuition campaigns with science. So Karl Rove was well aware of a large body of literature, over 250 studies across 13 cultures, that show that if you make people aware of their mortality and you keep that salient in their mind, you will actually shift them to the right ideologically. That was one reason to shift to the war on terror, as to make people terrified. But the second reason to do it is because they wanted to have a war. They were already planning the war in Iraq. And by expanding it to the war on terror, you could have those two things elided into one network, the war on terror, which now includes the war against bin Laden and the war against the war in Iraq. And it was a brilliant move, and it was one that you'd think that someone somewhere in the Democratic side would have noticed. But just recently, just to give an example of how the Democrats get outflanked by the Republicans in their lack of understanding of how associations work. When did General Petraeus present his testimony to the Senate on the state of the war in Iraq? On 9/11. Now, if you were a Democrat and you're in charge of scheduling hearings, which the Democrats are because they are in a majority, it is hard to recognize, but they are in a majority, the last date you would ever put General Petraeus on is 9/11, because all you're doing is you've just spent a year trying to break the association between the war against terrorists and the war in Iraq, and now you're going to have on the news that day intermingled stories about the anniversary of 9/11 and the Iraq war, and you're going to have a general who's going to talk repeatedly about al-Qaeda in Iraq. So what have you just done? You've just reinforced a network that you were trying to break, and that the fact that you were able to break it in 2006 actually won you an election. That's the kind of example of just really simple, basic principles of association that Aristotle understood 2,500 years ago that Republicans understand very, very well, and Democrats just can't seem to catch on to.
Thank you for this illuminating talk. We're short on time, so I'll try to make this short, but it may take a long answer. When you talk, I'm a psychologist, and also I'm proud to say I'm a liberal. And I'm also aware that as a liberal, one of the things you were talking earlier about what defines us is that we do look at both sides of an issue. And I'm proud to be able to do that. And I'm a media psychologist. I do that on the radio. And a lot of times they'll say, well, you know, get more straight and abrupt and so forth.
Need to ask this in the form of a question.
And the question is, how do you be a liberal and, you know, get this message across while still being true to that there are more sides to it than just one way to look at it?
It's a great question, and you know, you actually did a very good job of keeping the question short. I've been the one who's done the opposite, which is take short questions and give long answers. The thing that I think often snags liberals when they talk to constituents who are not as liberal as they are is that they think, they're just not going to get the complexity of this issue. And I think that's I think just as the Republicans often have the conceit of moral superiority, Democrats often have the conceit of intellectual superiority. And I think Carville and Begala wrote about that in their book, and I think they were, it was called Take It Back, and I think they're exactly right, is there are very few stands that you actually can't get into the basic gist of it into three or four sentences. And you can't get everything into two-word or three-word slogans, which Republicans are much better at. I mean, if you believe that life begins at conception, it's easy. Life begins at conception. I mean, what is a stance on the other side? Life doesn't begin at conception. That's not very powerful. Life begins at the birth canal. I don't think many people actually believe that. So it's not as easy to do. But if you take an issue like abortion is a great example, where Democrats are tongue-tied everywhere outside the Northeast and Northern California and parts of the Midwest, and they give these kind of hedging answers. And even Democrats from those parts of the country will vote for things like the quote-unquote partial birth abortion ban, a term, by the way, that was developed by the right and market-tested by the right and is part of the conservative brand. And Democrats are consistently like Pepsi executives going around humming, "It's the real thing." I mean, you don't do that if you're a Pepsi executive. You don't use Coke's branding. So you wouldn't call it partial birth abortion. But if you think about what a principled stand on the left would be on, say, abortion, and you'd be surprised to know that 60% of evangelical Christians in this country believe that we should find a middle ground on abortion. You'd never know that, would you? Or that only 30% of Americans believe life begins at conception, no ifs, ands, or buts. Meaning, no matter the life of the mother, no matter whether you're talking about rape or incest. Well, how often have you heard Democrats say, suppose I were running in rural Virginia, to say to fathers in rural Virginia, my opponent over here believes that if your 16-year-old daughter gets raped, that she should have only two choices if she gets pregnant. One of them is to raise that child and to see the eyes of her rapist every day for the rest of her life and her baby, or to give up your and her flesh and blood. Now, he thinks that's a moral position. I think that's immoral. To me, that's a rapist's bill of rights. What that says is that every rapist has the right to choose the mother of his child. I do not believe that. I believe that if your daughter is raped, it is up to her and up to you to figure out what to do about that. And that that we should not have big government coming in and imposing somebody else's faith to make sure that rapist can sit there in prison chuckling, wondering what his child's going to look like. To me, that's the kind of thing that you could say as a Democrat that gives a much more, get some of the emotional complexity into it, that, when you just say I'm pro-life or I'm pro-choice, I'm fond of going into Democratic audiences and saying, I actually don't know anybody who's pro-choice. And I'll ask them first, are you pro-choice? They'll raise their hand. I'll say, I actually don't know anyone who's really pro-choice. Do you really believe that if a woman came in at 9 months and said, I'm perfectly healthy, my baby's perfectly healthy, but I just changed my mind? Now, that wouldn't happen. I mean, you might see a case of that from a psychotic woman once every 6 years. But very few of us would say, that's fine, it's her right. Because at that point, I mean, what's the difference between just out of the birth canal and just in it? The reality is that when life begins is something that some theologians claim to know, but most of us actually have a graded conception of life unconsciously, no matter what we say, which is that early on, most of us believe that stem cell research is okay. Most of us believe that in vitro fertilization is okay, even though it means, quote unquote, wasting embryos. Is that wasting souls? Most of us believe that when the life of the mother is in danger, it's okay to have abortion. Most of us believe that early on, the rights of the mother trump the rights of a fetus. But the more and more that fetus becomes person-like, the more it gives us the creeps. That's what our moral intuition is, and that's how Democrats could talk about abortion. And that's actually what Roe v. Wade said. It just says it in a very different kind of way.
I wish I could have taken your course on this. It would have been wonderful. But I was wondering, do you have any indication that either Obama or Hillary, who evidently doesn't listen to Bill on how to, have an emotional approach, do you have any indication that they are listening to what you and people like you are saying? And if you have any ideas what regular people can do to try to make them wake up, I appreciate it.
I'm now going to do exactly what I advise against strongly in my book, which is to give a slightly evasive answer, but I'll make it as unevasive as I can. I do know that two of the major presidential candidates have read the book. I've had conversations with either them or people very, actually I've had conversations with people very high up in the three major candidates organizations. I've seen some of the effects show up in debates, for example. I'd like to see a lot more. I mean, I think if you look at what's happening with Obama's stagnating campaign right now, what you're seeing is the influence of this overly rationalistic, dispassionate vision of the mind that says, and an overzealous response to the pundits, mostly from places in the Northeast, who are saying, you got to have your 16-point health care plan, you've got to have your 14-point energy plan, otherwise people will say you don't have substance. So in Iowa, he ran an ad where he mentioned a lot how he went to Harvard Law School. What he already has working against him is disidentification from being black that he's got to overcome. The last thing he needs is for people not to identify with him because they see him as different because he went to Harvard and they don't go to Harvard. Or they didn't go to Harvard, they went to Iowa State and that was good enough for them. I'll conclude with just this last thought is that there's a distinction made in my home field of psychotherapy between cognitive insight and emotional insight, where cognitive insight is you go, oh, yeah, I see that. Emotional insight is, my God, I see that. I've been repeatedly picking people who are bad for me as romantic partners, haven't I, because of this thing from my childhood where I learned that, X, Y, or Z. And that's when you see change happen. What I'm seeing is a lot of cognitive insight on the part of Democrats. The emotional insight may take a few years to follow. Again, thank you all very much.